Support for the Front Porch comes from the Charleston Gazette Mail, providing both sides of the story on their dueling editorial pages. The Charleston Gazette and the Charleston Daily Mail side by side. Check it out at wvgazettemail.com. Hi, I'm Scott Finn, and you're on the Front Porch. I'm joined, as always, by Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
And Lori Lynn of the Charleston Daily Mail editorial page. Hey.
Hi.
And today we're going to be talking about the shootings that have been going on in this country, the mass shootings in West Virginia and the West Virginia gun culture. And Rick, we're going to play a game today?
Yeah, the game is called the gun to people ratio game. It's one that I sometimes do when I teach a sociology class, and it consists of having people go around and state how many people live in their house versus how many firearms live in their house.
So stick around for the gun to people ratio game. This is being recorded, by the way, on Thursday morning. And as of Thursday morning, we know that there's been a shooting in California. We know that there are two suspects that are dead, but we don't know why they did it. One of the things I want to talk about, since we don't know, is why is it that we want to find a reason for these things so quickly? What is it about us as human beings that need to put this into some sort of category?
Yeah, it's really hard to say. If you go on social media in the minutes or immediate hours after one of these shootings, it's really an awful place to be, because it's people just lining up on either side and speculating and just really a lot of nastiness. I mean, there was this, and then a few days before there was the Planned Parenthood shooter, and of course that was terrorism and supposedly a big statement about the right and violent rhetoric.
People jumped on that bandwagon very quick. I mean, yeah. The shooter was still on the loose, and people were already scoring political points off of the Planned Parenthood shooting. Rick, you're saying that there's a sociological idea behind why we feel this need to jump to some sort of answer.
There's a term that I've heard that I think is really kind of useful called the narrative fallacy, and it means that because we construct a story about why something happened, it has some reason, it has some connection with what actually happened. And I think people are probably hardwired to want narrative or story. I mean, we make them up all the time. And you drive by and see a couple talking about something on the road, and you just automatically construct a story about what's going on here. And we say, what's the story? And so I think it's a really deeply ingrained thing. But
is that because we need to feel safer? Is it that sort of need? What's driving our desire to have the story right away?
No, I think Rick's right. I think it is ingrained. And, the story isn't always comforting. I mean, sometimes the story is, disturbed guy goes into an elementary school and kills 12 children. And, I don't think it's necessarily about feeling more comfortable. I think the media both feeds into it and then feeds off of it. Whoever is the first to kind of wrap it up in a box and explain why it happened gets, more hits and more clicks.
I mean, I think there are three ways that people have made sense of the world. One is stories, one is sort of logically thinking about things, and one is science. But the deepest and the oldest and the one that cuts the closest to the bone is the story. And even in science, the whole point of science in a way is to come up with a story that's actually the case.
I heard an interesting story in Morning Edition. There was a psychologist on talking about how, we're looking for the quote-unquote reason why this happened. Is it terrorism? Is it a workplace shooting? Is it domestic violence? When, in fact, it starts with the individual person and their upbringing, their psychology, their grievances, and then they find some ideology to hang their mass shooting on, so that it's not necessarily the Planned Parenthood shooter didn't go crazy from hearing about, abortion. The Planned Parenthood shooter had issues all along and decided to become a mass shooter, and that this was just the target he picked because of the ideology that was out there.
Yeah, I think fair enough. I mean, I think if you look at, for example, Paris, that case might be a little bit harder to make. So, I definitely see that more with kind of the lone shooter, the Charleston guy, the Virginia Tech guy, a troubled person in search of a justification for violence.
And part of what we know about this shooting that's so shocking is that it's a man and supposedly his wife or fiance. They had a 6-month-old daughter who they dropped off at his mom's house on the way to the shooting. It's so old, but then there's always some new detail that makes it even more painful.
Yeah, mass shootings by women are really almost unheard of. So this, you know, that alone makes this case very unusual.
Yeah, if we were profiling a mass shooting incident in the United States, first thing that would come to my mind is a white male with a sense of grievance. I think often ideology is a part of these things. I mean, you can think about Timothy McVeigh or the Olympic bomber or others. I think, on the other hand, on the mass culture, a lot of people have different sense of grievances and frustrations that might be drawn to rhetoric or to causes, you know, that speak to that and that might provide an excuse or an outlet for acts of violence, and that happens anywhere.
Gun violence in this country is not on the increase overall, and yet there seems to be, and there is some evidence, that there's an increase in these mass shootings. Lori, what's going on there? What do we know?
Yeah, most people, I think, if you ask the average person, they would have the sense that gun violence in general has skyrocketed, but that's actually gone down quite. Gun crime, gun violence, gun homicides have all gone down quite a bit. I think the high was in 1993. Mass shootings are up, and mass shootings are only when four or more people are killed or wounded. That's only about 1% of all gun violence, but, you know, it's so visible. Social media heightens that effect, and they cluster too. There was a cluster, I don't know, 10 years ago maybe, and then there was a pause. There weren't nearly as many, and then recently, in the past couple of years, there have been quite a bit more.
So West Virginia has a large number of guns, is no secret. Appalachia as well.
And there's sixth in the country in gun ownership rate. I think it's around 58%.
So sixth in the country. And yet we haven't had an outrageous number of mass shootings, actually. Vox.com has put out a really great map, you should check it out, of all mass shootings in the country since Sandy Hook. And we were on there three times. One of them was for four people being shot and killed in the Morgantown region. You might remember this as sort of a love triangle. But, you know, you would think that with all these guns saturating West Virginia, that there would be more gun homicide, that there would be more mass shootings. Rick, what's going on?
Well, you often tell people that West Virginia is kind of an outlier and that we're a bunch of heavily armed poor people who are fairly nonviolent most of the time. You know, I've said this before in talking to people, and it's like a dark humor, but in general, I don't think we kill strangers here. Sadly, a lot of it is domestic violence. A lot of it's neighbors, you know, different kind of family, extended family
and
issues.
And gun deaths, it's important to remember, include suicide, and that, you know, here, both here and nationwide, is a big part of it. I think, mm-hmm. obviously, if we got rid of guns completely, there would be fewer suicides. I don't think anyone really argues with that. But it is a separate category, I think, from, you know, what we normally conceive of as gun violence.
What do we do about this? It seems almost like we've fallen into these patterns of there's an event like this, and then the left talks about gun control, and some people talk about mental health, but I don't ever see anyone, frankly, do anything about it. And nothing happens, and we move on to the next one. So let's pretend, let's not just give in to fatalism, let's pretend there are things that could be done. You know, what do y'all think we should be trying to do?
Well, that's really the question. I mean, you know, people come out, the president, a lot of people on the left come out and say, you know, it's time for sensible measures. It's time for some common sense reforms. What they really cannot do is point to something that would have stopped, you know, XYZ tragedy that just occurred. People talk about the gun show loophole where you can buy guns at gun shows without background check. You know, okay, I mean, I don't have any great objection to that, but I also don't think that there's a single instance of mass gun violence, you know, that I can recall recently where that was how the person got their gun.
I mean, to really have an effect, would we have to do things that are so outside of our culture that they can't even be imagined? Like Australia. What did Australia do after that large shooting down there? Didn't they outlaw almost all private gun ownership?
They had what they called a buyback program, which sounds really warm and fuzzy and casual and relaxed. It was actually a mandatory buyback. So they took your gun away and they would pay you for it. I think most people here would consider that to be confiscation. And it would, I mean, first of all, you have the Second Amendment issue. And then confiscation. I think that's a non-starter here. I can't imagine it.
So the part of the issue is to really have an effect, we would have to do things in this country that are beyond the pale of being imagined and possibly unconstitutional. Therefore, Democrats propose small things that they pretend would have an effect, but you're saying there's not any evidence it would have a huge effect. There is a prohibition against people who have been institutionalized for mental illness in this country from purchasing guns, and it's actually enforced out of Clarksburg, West Virginia, in the FBI center there. But the system has so many holes in it. There are all sorts of loopholes that you think that we could, in a bipartisan way, you know, close some of these. That would have been at least maybe make it just a little harder for someone who has mental issues from being able to purchase a gun, at least make them work at it a little more.
I think one factor is convenience. And I think that's one thing you said, Laurie, about, you know, if there weren't as many readily available, probably the suicide rate would go down because it's a lot harder to do it.
Yep.
Off a building or with a knife or with Drano or something like that.
Some people would still kill themselves,
right,
really
absolutely.
Determined, but then some wouldn't.
Right. So, I mean, I think if it is convenience. I'm not prepared to outline my program on this show today.
Candidate Rick Wilson.
What do you think of the president? Obama, I think, is weakly proposed or somewhat wanting to explore the idea of keeping people on the terror watch list from buying guns, which, you know, sounds like a good idea until you realize there are like 900,000 people on this terror watch list. They don't know that they're on it. The criteria for getting on it are not publicly known. You know, there's big due process issues. First of all, with the existence of the list entirely, I think a lot of civil libertarians would be very uncomfortable with it. But then when you're denying them the exercise of, you know, what is a fundamental constitutional right, I think that becomes even more controversial.
So one unintended consequence, one positive thing, a silver lining to all these mass shootings is that it appears the media is actually getting a little bit more responsible in covering these things.
I think a little bit. I think maybe particularly since Columbine, when we heard those kids' names over and over, and just the worry about the copycat effect that, you know, there's a troubled young man and for whatever reason, he thinks that this is a way to go into immortality. Just don't say his name over and over again. And I do think that media have gotten a little bit better about that over the past decade or so.
You see, not making it a celebrity, I guess.
Right.
Hey, we'll be right back to the front porch in just a minute. But first, I want to tell you about another podcast at West Virginia Public Broadcasting that you got to listen to if you haven't yet, Inside Appalachia. All the stories about the culture, the arts, the people, the history of the region that we all love. Hosted by Jessica Lilly, produced by Roxy Todd. You can listen to it, of course, on West Virginia Public Radio on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 6 p.m. But if you want to listen to it on your own time, then check it out on iTunes, on SoundCloud, and of course, as always, at wvpublic.org.
So, Rick, you're a hunter, right?
Well,
you're the gun.
There's not a lot of evidence for that this season. Let me put it that way.
As you sit here in your orange, you can't see Rick, but he's wearing his fluorescent orange jacket.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that strikes me here is how ingrained the hunting culture is. You know, Senator Kessler, who's a very liberal senator. It amazed me that he voted in favor of the permitless concealed carry bill in the last session, which, you know, the governor then vetoed as being too extreme. Do you think we're an outlier in a way? I mean, it is a hunting and self-defense kind of culture,
right? It is very much a hunting culture. And I think for a lot of people, this is a way families bond, and it's a sort of a rite of passage. And again, my nephew and I were out in the woods this week unsuccessfully, so... I mean, the evidence, yeah, if you count me as a hunter based on, you know, deer bag, that would not qualify this year or last year.
Well, I was surprised that schools were closed the entire week of Thanksgiving, and then someone said, oh, well, that's a hunting deer season thing.
That's because resistance is pointless. You know, I think people might have tried to have like a two-day Thanksgiving, and it just wasn't happening. And so
it's one of the most lovely things about living in West Virginia that they do that. It's amazing because it is a sign of two things going on at once. It's about hunting culture. It's also about a family culture and a family tradition. It's so strong that the school system doesn't dare to send kids to school during that week.
I noticed last week people were talking about how there was such a high number of deer, and you know, here's how you can donate it to your food pantry or whatever, you know, whatever place would accept venison for hungry people. And you know, I mean, that's awesome.
Lori was amazed, let me just say, that I did not get one, since everyone else in the state apparently did.
I didn't mean to rub it in. That's Rick. Right. I'm sorry.
Wow. Yeah, wow.
Did you catch that?
There were a lot of deer, Rick.
I'm planning on putting a spear like on the front bumper of my car. I think I might have more luck that way.
So tell us about this game, this gun to people ratio game that you play.
Let's play it right here and right now. And the way you play it is you disclose the number of people in your household and the number of firearms in your household. And I can prove I'm a true hillbilly in that there are more firearms than people in my house.
You have to play the game, though, right?
Yeah,
what is it?
3-2 in my case.
3 guns to 2 people.
Yeah, and they're hunting. They're all hunting things.
Well, yeah, describe your guns. Just curious.
12-gauge, an old 22, and a 270, which is a hunting rifle.
See, this is so embarrassing. I hate that you're making me do this. I have 0 guns. So 0 out of 4 is still 0, right? That's a very bad ratio for West Virginia.
What's just like for our group, it's still 3-2. Well, now how many people in your house?
4.
4. Oh, wow. All right.
Yeah, we're a very gun
math here. Wait a minute.
The abnormal group in this group.
This is public radio.
I'm hoping Lori comes through for us here.
Well, we have 4 people in our house, soon to be 5, and just 1 gun. We have a handgun that we keep locked up for potential defense of the home. So, yeah, I guess we're pretty weak here as far as the
10 game. 10-4 is kind of an unusual.
So even in a sociology class at Marshall?
I usually teach off campus when I teach. Okay. And like at, I'd say, Hurricane High School or something. And, oh, like there's some people who have like 30 or 40 in their house, arsenals. usually when we look at the numbers at the end, it's like, you know, where else would you find this ratio, maybe a cave in Afghanistan somewhere. But again, to close on not a downer note, there's some research that indicates that actually violence has decreased throughout human history. Mm-hmm. And if you look at people in pre-state societies, hunter-gatherers, it appears by some evidence that there are actually more homicide and violent deaths in prehistory than there are now, even during the bloody 20th century. If you look at violent deaths as a percent of the population, it's probably fewer. I mean, there were more, the numbers were larger, but the percentages were smaller. So, I mean, some people argue we're actually becoming less violent as we move along. At least we don't have gladiator games anymore. We got Ultimate Fighting, which
we're learning how to fight in other ways, like through dueling editorial pages.
One other thought.
Charleston Gazette Mail. And let me finish my underwriting spot here. I'm weaving it in effortlessly. Here we go.
Full circle.
You know, it's like you can fight without necessarily being, objectionable. What is that? You can
disagree without being disagreeable.
Thank you, Lori Lynn. So check it out at our underwriter, the Charleston Gazette Mail at wvgazettemail.com. Thank them so much for being on board with that. And Tudor's Biscuit World, we're still waiting on you.
We're waiting. You're playing hard to get.
You know, speaking of hunting, the first time I ever went to Tudor's Biscuit World was on, I think it was the second day of hunting season last year. And it was early in the morning. I mean, it was, I think I was the only person not wearing camouflage in the entire Tudor's. It was really amazing. And it gave me a really weird impression of Tudor's. You know, you go back and it's not all hunters all the time, but
right.
That day it was.
All right, I'm gonna say something about myself that's really embarrassing, which is I went for a hike in the Kanawha State Forest the other day. I come up and over the hill, come down, and there's a hunter right there. I had completely even forgotten that it was buck hunting.
You can hunt in Kanawha State Forest?
Oh, yeah, it's a state forest, yeah. It's not a state park. State park, you can't hunt
in. Not just
in.
Anywhere, though. There must be.
The only places you can't hunt in Kanawha State Forest are right next to the road. Which I knew, but I was so far, I'm so un-West Virginian in some ways that I completely forgot that it would be hunting season.
So I could be hiking down a trail with my kids?
Totally, yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
Which I knew, but I'd forgotten. So there you go, okay. Rick.
I put a bandana around the dog. Sometimes we take our walks in the woods, you know.
I didn't have any blaze orange, nothing.
Wow.
So if you have any doubt about my permanent outsider status in West Virginia,
did not realize that.
So by the way, a little historical note, the samurai hated guns and they tried to suppress them because they represented the democratization of violence and they felt like anybody can kill somebody with a gun, but it took a certain amount of training and to be able to do it with a sword. It's just,
you know, and I think that's where liberals sometimes fall short in understanding why there's such a love of guns and gun culture. It's not just about the hunting. They're like, oh, well, you can still go hunting. That's all fine. I think it's about the democratization of violence. I've never heard that before, but that's fascinating. I think it's exactly why people love them so much. They don't want the violence to be held by the state. They want the ability to have violence to be held by the individual. And our individualistic culture in Appalachia embraces that.
And there's a, like, some more, I don't want to get too geeky here, but there's a
book
called Cultures of Honor, where they argue that in societies where there's weak or illegitimate central authority and when a lot of wealth is easily takeable, like herding and things like that, you know, you really need to, you know, it makes sense to be a, not to present a, the ability to defend yourself credibly. And that's where cultures of honor tend to emerge, where if it's easy to take something away from you, people, well, prisons are kind of a culture of honor. But if you look at places where violent rates are high, they tend to be in places where a culture of honor have kind of developed, where, you know, that's the way you respond to a personal insult, where your well-being or even survival depends on your presenting yourself in such a way that you can defend what you have.
Is West Virginia then a culture of honor?
Some would say, yeah.
Certainly historically, I would think.
Yeah, historically.
Maybe not as much these days.
We've been talking about gun violence in West Virginia. We've been talking about the mass shootings going on in America today. And I really appreciate Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee and Lori Lynn of the Charleston Daily Mail editorial page. It's always, after talking to you all, I feel like I don't necessarily have any answers, but at least I feel like we're trying to make sense of the world and things like this. And that always feels good. So thank you.
We're making up stories, right?
That's right. It's all about the stories.